For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
So we're expecting Shavuot Okamura Roshi later this morning. I will begin this weekend teaching on Kanon Bodhisattva of Great Compassion with some introduction. The three texts that Shavuot was using this weekend are all about one story about Kanon, and the story is about how the working of Great Compassion, how Great Compassion works for this Bodhisattva, and it's a story, a dialogue based on three different commentaries on a dialogue between two great 9th century Chan or Zen masters, Yunyan and Daowu, very important in our Soto Zen lineage. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit, but first some background about this great Bodhisattva of Compassion. Kanon is one Japanese name. Kanzeon, hearing sound, is Kanon. Hearing the sounds of the world is Kanzeon. In Sanskrit, Avalokiteshvara, and in Tibetan Chenrezig or in Chinese Guanyin, the most popular bodhisattva in Mahayana Buddhism, enlightening being dedicated to saving all beings, but particularly the bodhisattva of compassion. And her name means hearing sounds, or as Kanzeon, hearing the sounds of the world. So compassion in Buddhism is, in one aspect, just merely sympathetic listening, empathetic listening, hearing the suffering of the world, remaining opening to the suffering of the world. This is fundamental to what compassion is in Buddhism. But also, there's the principle of response of compassion for this bodhisattva. And that's really what we're talking about this weekend. How is it that compassion works? How is it that the bodhisattva of compassion responds and expresses compassion? This is very subtle. And part of that is that there are a great many different forms of this bodhisattva. So this story is based on one of those many forms. But actually, part of what this bodhisattva of compassion represents, along with empathetic listening, is skillful means, responding to beings in the particular way that they need and recognizing the diversity of beings in the world. So there are many different forms. And in my Faces of Compassion book, I talk about some of those different forms. It may be hard to see from the back, but there is this basic form of just the simple two-armed, one-headed, Kanon, the goddess of mercy that you've all seen in Chinese restaurants. Very simple, sometimes holding a vase or a jar with nectar, just expressing compassion for the world. Sometimes there are multiple arms, like this one. That's a Tibetan version. This one also represents 11 heads. So sometimes one of the forms of the bodhisattva of compassion has 11 heads to see from different perspectives. And actually, we have two Kanon Bodhisattvas in our Zendo. And there are many different forms. There's seven major forms, and then the Lotus Sutra talks about 33 forms, one of which is in the picture above Paula and Jerry there, sitting on a leaf floating on the ocean. Another one you'll have to look closely later is on this iron plaque on the wall there, and that one has 11 heads. So many different forms of this bodhisattva of compassion, intentionally designed to provide different perspectives. This one is sitting in a relaxed pose and holding a tiny jewel in her hand, which is a wish-fulfilling gem, a jewel. So part of what Kanon sometimes does is just grant any wish that that someone asks for. So just to give, just to be generous and give what is asked for, kind of like a genie. There are other forms of Kanon in a relaxed pose. So this is after sitting many hours, maybe just this relaxed kind of pose that sometimes Kanon takes. However, excuse me, the form that is discussed in this story is the thousand-armed form. I should say, first of all, that there's also various names in addition to the different translations in different cultures. There's Kanzeon in Japanese and also Kanjizai, which is the name of the bodhisattva of compassion used in the Heart Sutra we sometimes chant. In Japanese, it's Kanjizai. Shohaku translates this as freely seeing bodhisattva. Various ways to translate that. So there are many different aspects of this bodhisattva, and that's part of the point of compassion, to respond in various different ways, to see and hear the suffering of being in various different ways, to listen and regard the suffering of the world in all the different ways that beings are suffering. But in this story, that is the focus for this weekend, the main figure that's talked about is the thousand-armed. One of the major forms of the bodhisattva's compassion is the thousand-armed bodhisattva. So I'll come back to that. I'm going to just read the basic story. And we have three different texts that you all have. One is from the Book of Serenity, the Shoya Roku. It's case 54 in that koan collection. Another is from the Blue Cliff Record, or case 89. And it's the same story, but different commentary. And then Shohaku has provided us kindly with a commentary by Dogen. I'll give a fuller introduction to Shohaku later, but he and I have translated numbers of texts of Dogen together and worked together in Japan and San Francisco. This is his new translation of one of the essays from one of Dogen's major works, Shobo Genzo, True Dharma Eye Treasury, called Kanon, about Avalokiteshvara. And Dogen's main commentary on Kanon is simply this story. So this is a new translation of this essay by Dogen, and Dogen says some interesting things in here about this. In this introduction, I want to focus, and Shohaku will say more about them, on these two koan commentaries. So just to say a little bit, the Book of Serenity, Shoya Roku in Japanese, and that's the one that's number 54, case 54, is more in the Soto tradition. That's based on the cases and verses from Hongzhe, who was a great 12th century, 1100s Chinese Soto teacher, great predecessor of Dogen. So it has more of a kind of gentle or Soto style. The Blue Cliff Record, which is the format that the Book of Serenity is based on, is a little bit earlier, and a little bit more of a Dharma combat style. But anyway, both of these have this basic story. And so I want to start, I want to read the basic story. I'll read the version in the Both of these translations are by Thomas Cleary. The Book of Record one is by Thomas Cleary and his brother J.C. Cleary. But the Book of Serenity version, Yunyan asked Dawu, "What does the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion do with so many hands and eyes?" Dawu said, "It's like someone reaching back for the pillow at night." Or you could read it as, "It's like someone reaching back, groping for their pillow in the middle of the night." Yunyan said, "Ah, I understand." Dawu said, "How do you understand?" Yunyan said, "All over the body is hands and eyes." Dawu said, "You said a lot there, but you only got 80%. Yunyan said, "What about you, elder brother?" Dawu said, "Throughout the body is hands and eyes." So that's the basic story we're going to be talking about all weekend. And I'll come back to that and talk about who Yunyan and Dawu are. But I don't know that any of the commentaries specifically, well, actually, no, one of them does talk about thousand arms, hands, and eyes. But just so you know what this refers to, I brought some pictures which I'm going to pass around. This is from a temple in Kyoto called Sanju Sangendo. It's a very long temple. It used to be the walkway on the outside of it used to be used for archery matches. It's a very long, straight walkway. But inside there's this amazing event where there's a thousand of these standing bodhisattvas of compassion, each with, well, I don't know if they're literally a thousand. Maybe they're literally a thousand, but there's some number that represents a thousand, and they each have 11 heads, including Amida Buddha on the top. So this bodhisattva of compassion is part of all the schools of Mahayana Buddhism, very important in Zen, as you see from this Zen dialogue, but also in Pure Land Buddhism. That is that Chan Sanama Amida Buddha, this bodhisattva is one of the two main attendants to Amida Buddha, so always Amida Buddha is on the crown of the head. These look pretty similar, but each one is individually sculpted. They're not like machine made out of a mold. I'll pass this around so you can see. There's a close-up of some of them that's marked here. And they're beautiful, beautiful statues. Each one of them, sometimes there'll be some on loan, so if you, some of the museums in Japan, you can see one of them from the Sanju Sangendo. And they're really beautiful statues. And there's a thousand of them. So there's a thousand armed kanons, 500 on each side, and then in the middle, seated on a lotus pedestal, is this thousand armed, literally, kanon, and with 11 heads and Amida, and then there's a kind of nimbus or halo around it with many Buddhas around that. So I just wanted you to see what this is referring to. So people from Japan sort of take this for granted. This is what this kanon is. But this, literally, this thousand, these thousand hands, you know, they ask in the story, what does the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Literally, he has a thousand hands. And actually, in China, the Bodhisattva of Compassion is almost always female, Guan Yin. In India and Tibet, it's male, but there's also the Tara is a female form that came from a tear from Avalokiteshvara. And we have a Tara right outside the door here, sitting on the table. And in Japan, it's kind of androgynous. There's a little mustache, but it's also kind of, the features are very soft. But the hands and eyes, there's the eyes on all of the heads above the main head, but also each hand has an eye in the palm. So if there's a thousand hands, there's also a thousand eyes. So to see the suffering of the world and to hear the suffering of the world. But also, one of the things that comes up in the commentaries is, what is this reaching back for the pillow in the middle of the night? And how do we see? And how do we hear? And hearing with your eyes, and seeing with your nose and tongue. And anyway, that's part of the story too. In addition to having an eye in each hand, many of the hands, and you'll see this, you can see this in the standing thousand-armed Kanongs, they have implements in their hands. So that's not part of this particular koan or story, but each of the hands has various implements, all kinds of things. There's lassos, there's jars with nectar, there's beads, there's arrows, there's Buddhas, there's sun and moon, there's many, many different kinds of implements, and there's a whole iconography about that. There's bells, there's a skull in one, there's a whisk, there's a lotus, so there's a Dharma wheel. So I want to pass this around so that you can see these thousand hands and eyes of this Bodhisattva of compassion. So again, there are many, many different forms of this Bodhisattva of compassion. But in this story, they're referring to this, you know, very colorful thousand-armed, thousand-handed Bodhisattva of great compassion. So again, the Bodhisattva of compassion just hears the sounds, hears sounds. And actually there's one in the Surangama Sutra, I sometimes recommend students to, as a focusing tool in Zazen, you know, to focus on breath, but also sometimes to focus on sound. And that's also part of the Bodhisattva of compassion in the Surangama Sutra, which turns out was actually written in China, not India, but it was very popular in China, and they in it the Bodhisattva of compassion recommends listening to sound as a meditation focus. So, and I would recommend it too. It's very helpful as a settling tool when you need to settle in Zazen. But so again, there's this side of the Bodhisattva of compassion, which is just to hear the sounds, and just to be open to the suffering of the world, and just to listen. To actually listen. To listen to your own suffering and the suffering of others, and to not shut yourself off from your own suffering and the suffering of others. But this Bodhisattva of compassion is receptive, but also is not passive. So how does the Bodhisattva of compassion respond? So Yunyan's question, what does the Bodhisattva of compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Or the version in the Blue Cliff Record, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes for? How do you use all of those hands? So the version in the translation of Shōhaku's translation of the Shōbō Genzo, the question is, what does the great compassion Bodhisattva do with innumerable hands and eyes? So this is the basic question. How does the Bodhisattva of compassion use all these hands and eyes? What does it do with all these hands and eyes? So again, this weekend Shōhaku is going to comment on three different sets of commentaries about this question. And I'll say a little bit about this. But I want to talk a little bit about... I've talked a little bit about the Book of Serenity, the Book of Record. Maybe I should say a little bit about Dogen. Maybe you all know who Dogen is. The Shōbō Genzo, True Dharma, I Treasury, is... This is the one that Shohak, who has given us this new translation of. So Dogen is the founder in the 13th century of Soto Zen, the branch of Zen that we do. He was a Japanese monk who went to China and brought back this tradition of Soto Zen from China to Japan and established what's now called Soto Zen. He didn't call it that. He didn't even call it Zen. He just said, this is the Buddha way. But he wrote quite a lot. He wrote, Shobo Genzo is his most famous writing, and there are various different versions of that. The full modern version, there are 95 different essays, and they're very poetic and philosophical and elaborate, and they usually, like this one, start with one story or one theme or one teacher and then go off in different directions, and very playful and difficult, challenging, but also in some ways very comforting, and they were his teachings to his monks. Shohaku and I translated one of those Bendo Wa in the book The Wholehearted Way, one of the earliest of Dogen's writings about the basic meaning of Zazen. So, and then, but Dogen had many other writings. He also wrote another book that Shohaku and I translated in Japan when I was living there in Kyoto, was the Dogen's Pure Standards for the Zen Community, which talks about the different positions, many of which we have here, even in our small non-residential temple, like the Tenzo and the Eno and the director and the work leader, and also various forms for the monastic practice. And some of those we use, again, even in modern American non-residential temples. And then the other major work besides Shobo Genzo that Dogen did was the Geihei Koroku, or Extensive Record, which Shohaku and I translated in San Francisco, a very thick work with very short little talks. Anyway, Dogen was very important in bringing this tradition to Japan from China, and bringing the koan tradition, these teaching stories, to Japan, and founding this lineage of Soto Zen in Japan. And his writings are now important in translation in the West. So anyway, I could start talking about Dogen and go on and on, but we have this wonderful new translation by Shohaku Roshi about Kanon that he'll be talking about. But one of the things about this tradition of Soto is the Japanese for Saodong in Chinese, and this Saodong tradition is very ancient, and it goes back to there are many, many wonderful figures in the Chinese Saodong tradition. I mentioned Hongzhe a century before Dogen. The founder of that tradition is Dongshan, who we've talked about earlier this year a lot. He wrote, or is considered the writer of, the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi we talked about a lot in the spring. And his teacher is this Yunyan we're talking about this weekend. So Yunyan and Dawu, or their Japanese names, Ungan and Dogo, are very important in our tradition too. They were actually, apparently, as well as Dharma brothers, they were actually biological brothers. And there are many, many, many stories where there are dialogues between them. So this is just one of them that we're going to focus on this weekend. One of the others I've talked about a lot is about Yunyan saying, you should know there's one who's not busy, when he was cleaning the temple, and Dawu challenged him about him being too busy. In this story, though, they're talking about compassion, and how does compassion work? So all this has been sort of the background to this story. How does the Bodhisattva of compassion use all these hands and eyes? That image that's going around of the Bodhi, this weird image of this Bodhisattva of compassion with all these different hands with implements, and it's kind of this far out science fictiony image, and mythological image. What does this mean about us and about compassion and about our practice? This is the point of these stories and the point of these images. So again, Yunyan asked Dawu, what does the Bodhisattva great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? And Dawu said, it's like someone reaching back for their pillow in the middle of the night. So just that response is so interesting. I love that response as an image for there's more to the story. I'm not sure I've ever understood the rest of the story, so I'm looking forward to hearing what Kumara Roshi has to say about it. But just that image of someone reaching back for your pillow in the middle of the night. So skillful means is something that the Bodhisattva of Compassion specializes in responding skillfully to the needs and to the suffering of beings, responding compassionately. What does it mean to respond compassionately? What is the active aspect of compassion? There's this aspect of compassion that is just listening carefully. Respectfully, really listening. So we know how wonderful that is when we actually feel heard ourselves. And we have many members of our Sangha who are counselors or therapists or psychologists whose vocation is to listen well and respond from that. So here in this great Bodhisattva of compassion, what is the principle of response? What does the Bodhisattva of compassion do with so many hands and eyes? So I don't know, would it be helpful to a therapist to have many hands and eyes? Maybe it would be helpful to have many ears. But then, so this question of hands and eyes and ears is also part of this. Reaching back for your pillow in the middle of the night. So in the middle of the night when you're asleep or just groggy or pillow has been dislodged, or maybe you need another pillow. And so maybe many of you have had this experience, and you reach back with your hand, and your fingers touch something. Maybe your hand is actually seeing something. Oh, there's that pillow. What is this reaching? What is this groping? What is this searching? And then what is this we have the actual Chinese characters here, at least the version of that Dogen uses in the Shobo Genzo. Yeah, it just says, in the night. You could read it as in the middle of the night. But it's in darkness, in night. And that has a kind of, on one level, that's just, it's dark. But in terms of light and dark and how that's used as an image in actually Yunyan's teacher's teacher, Shuto, wrote The Harmony of Difference and Sameness, and talk, which we chant sometimes. It talks about dark and light, and in that teaching poem, dark is an image for well, you could say emptiness, but more like sameness. This, when it's totally dark, you can't really see things. There's no distinctions. This pillow is this. Is this Nancy over here? What? You can't. There's no. It's all one. So in the middle of the night, what can we see? What can we touch? What can we feel? Anyway, this is what Daowu says is how the Bodhisattva of compassion uses all of these hands and eyes. It's like reaching back for your pillow in the middle of the night. So there's this reaching, there's this nighttime, there's this dark. And there's also the pillow. What is the pillow? The pillow is kind of comfort. Something soft. Actually, in Japan, they use these very hard pillows. They're filled with knees or something. But do you know those pillows, Caitlin? And you put them on. They're actually quite comfortable, I think, but they're not the kind of pillows we use. I don't know. And I think in China, they used to use ceramic pillows. Or their head on. Anyway. So I don't know. But for me, when I think of pillow, I think of something soft and gentle. So this is the basic question here that we're going to be considering this weekend. What is the response? How does the Bodhisattva of compassion function? What is this compassion? How do we use the tools we have? So probably most of us only have two hands and two eyes. How do we use them? How do we respond to the suffering of the world? It's like someone who is reaching his hand behind, groping for the pillow in the night. Down the sit. Yunyan said, I understand. Daowu said, how do you understand? And Yunyan said, all over the body is hands and eyes. So hands and eyes are not just hands and eyes. Hands and eyes are everything. Daowu said, you said a lot, but you only got 80%. Yunyan said, what about you, elder brother? And Daowu said, throughout the body is hands and eyes. And, you know, in Dogen's commentary, he's, you know, wonders if there's really a difference there. And so, again, we'll hear what Shohaku has to say about this. But I thought I would go into the introductions to the Book of Serenity and the Bukbif Record and talk about that a little bit. We can go into the cases a little bit, but maybe I'll pause there and just see if any of you have questions or comments or responses about hands and eyes at this point, or about the Bodhisattva of Compassion, or questions about this Bodhisattva of Compassion. Visual aid is still going around. What do you think of those images of the thousand hands and eyes, Asian?
I wasn't going to comment on the images, but I was just noticing the difference across the three texts. You know, the Book of Serenity and the Blue Clip Record have sort of a similar thing that Yun Nan Dawu are saying. They're saying at first, you know, all over the body is hands and eyes, and then the next one is throughout the body is hands and eyes. And then in Dogen's version, the first time they say throughout the body there are hands and eyes. So he's actually taking, you know, a step further. Because that's the second thing that is said. And he's saying the entire body is hands and eyes. And I wonder if you could even go a step further and say the whole world is hands and eyes.
Aha. What is it? He's got the whole world is hands and eyes. Right. So how do we see, where is the bodhisattva of compassion? How is the bodhisattva of compassion working?
It's like each statement breaks down a level of discrimination or distance.
Yeah, good, good, yeah. Yes, Tyler.
I think in Kazu's translation of the Shogun Rinpoche, that it says it's commonly sort of everywhere is hands and eyes.
Ah. Yeah, I didn't look at that. Good, thank you. Everywhere is hands and eyes. So that's probably, Kazu's translations are a little less literal and a little more interpretive, but also gets the feeling. Other comments or questions about this particular image of the thousand-armed, thousand-eyed bodhisattva, or just about the bodhisattva's compassion, or anything else? Again, these images are kind of strange, you know, that there are other images of bodhisattvas that are kind of strange. This one is maybe the strangest. You know, we might feel this as in some ways distancing. Well, that's kind of some supernatural super being or something. You know, maybe in Marvel Comics, but not in reality yet. All of these teachings are about something about how do we practice, in this case, how do we practice compassion? What is it like? And one of the main points here is that this skillful means, this function of compassion is not something that's calculated. You know, there's not, at least this is according to this story, there's not some instruction manual about how to fulfill bodhisattva compassion.
Isha? Well, I was thinking about that immediacy, that the hand is the eye. They're not separate. As you are reaching with your hand, there's an eye seeing.
Yes. So how we know things. So seeing is, you know, we see, oh, I see it now, is a way of saying that I know something. But how we see is, you know, I sometimes say I can reach in my pocket and I don't have a pocket. Well, I can reach in my sleeve and feel the difference between I've got a pen in there and I've got a handkerchief and I can tell the difference with my hand. So I'm seeing with my hand. Yes, Tyler.
I was studying the movements, so I was reading faces of compassion.
It's fine.
So I wanted to familiarize myself with the territory movement. There was one story in which the goddess had brought people out of samsara.
Yes.
And she turned and saw those places that were vacant, immediately back up with more bodies, more sentient beings, and it broke her heart in a way. And in that moment, it was cathartic, and she was immediately anatta. Is that?
Well, yeah.
Gave her these amazing skillful means to be even more empowered and more enabled. And I thought in our own lives, that when we pay attention and compassion, it's more spontaneous, it's not calculated. It's that willingness to open to receiving and seeing.
Yeah. I think that's, is that the story about how the 11 heads come about? Yeah, that she looked into, she rescued all beings from samsara. But I, the way you told it, I like too, is that, that it broke her heart and there was this empowerment. But one version of that story is that the 11 heads come from having looked into samsara after she saved all beings, and more beings are filling it up into the world of samsara, and her head splits apart, and that happens 11 times, so finally Amita puts the head on top and says, okay, proceed, you know. So yeah, how do we allow our hearts to be broken, or our heads to split open, however you want to see it? Actually, in Japanese, kokoro means heart or mind. It's not separate. So, how to allow our hearts to be broken. All of that points to this immediacy of response, this immediacy of helpfulness. Any other comments before we dive further into these cases? Well, just as starting points, rather than do, and I don't know exactly how Shohaku Roshi will proceed when he gets there, but I thought looking at the Book of Serenity and the Blue Cliff Record a little bit together, I would start with the introduction. So the way these are structured, just for your information, the cases and verses in both of them, in the Blue Cliff Record, the cases and then the main verse were done by a man named Shuedo, who's a great teacher in the Yunnan lineage. And then the what is called here the pointer and all the other commentary is done by a great Rinzai teacher named Yuan Wu. And then the same format for the Book of Serenity, the cases, the main cases were selected and the sequence chosen and then the verses, the main verse on page 231 and page 54 were, the cases and verses were by, selected by Hongzhi, great, great Chinese Soto teacher, the 1100s, some of his stuff I translated from Cultivating the Empty Field, wonderful teacher. And then later, another Soto teacher named Wan Song, which I've been finding out more about, interesting fellow, wrote all the different commentary around it. So the structure of these two commentaries are the same. And I told Paula, since she's a Qigong teacher, it turns out that I just found this out this week. Wan Song, who wrote the Book of Serenity commentaries, one of his students is the one who's responsible for Shaolin Monastery becoming a center of martial arts in the 1200s. And also a center of Shaodong into the 1300s. And his lineage still continues. So that was interesting. Anyway, so we have this story. Again, I'm just going to read it again. Yunyan asked Gao, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Jalu said, it's like someone reaching back for the pillow in the middle of the night. Yunyun said, I understand. Jalu said, how do you understand? And according to these versions, Yunyun said, all over the body is hands and eyes. And as was pointed out, Yunyan in the Dogen version says throughout the body of hands and eyes. Anyway, in both cases, Dao said that's pretty good, but you only got 80%. And Yunyan said, what about you, elder brother? And he says throughout the body is hands and eyes, or in Dogen's version, in the entire body is hands and eyes. So in the Book of Serenity and Blue Cliff Record, Wansong and Yuanwu, amongst their various other commentaries, have introductions to the cases. So I thought we'd start there. So for the Book of Serenity, it's shorter, even though this is later. Sometimes the Book of Serenity sort of is reflecting things in the Blue Cliff Record, particularly the commentaries, but I'll just start with the Book of Serenity. Crystal clear on all sides, open and unobstructed in all directions, emanating light and making the earth tremble in all places, subtly exercising spiritual powers at all times. Tell me, how is this manifested? So, this is Wansong's kind of, you know, introduction to this story. And, you know, he's celebrating this openness, this clarity, this light, making the earth tremble in all places, subtly exercising spiritual powers at all times. How is this manifested? How is it that this great compassion of the Bodhisattva Kanon is manifested? So this is his kind of introduction to this story, to this dialogue about, and again, that to me, each of these teaching stories have particular turning words or turning phrases, sometimes many of them. In this case, you know, we could look at just the question itself. Is, you know, worth, you know, considering, just Yunyan asking. You might see this image of all these hands and eyes, but to actually ask, what does the Bodhisattva of compassion do with so many hands and eyes? How does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use them? So that's that question itself. Before you go any further, that's pretty good. Asking that question, how to use all these hands and eyes? How to use these abilities, this awareness, these possibilities that we have. But then really, this Dao's response is, in a lot of ways, the key to this story, or the juice of the story. It's like someone reaching back for their pillow in the middle of the night. So that image, just reaching back for your pillow in the middle of the night. It's so commonplace on some level. Big deal, you know, okay. But how is that the workings of all of the hands and eyes of the great Bodhisattva of compassion? So, Wansong introduces this by saying, tell me, how is this manifested? And by all the, you know, by celebrating it, crystal clear on all sides, open, unobstructed in all directions, emanating light, making the earth tremble in all places, subtly exercising spiritual power at all times, even in the middle of the night. The Blue Cliff Record version, Yuanwu's introduction is longer and a little trippier. Same story. Yuanwu's pointer or introduction. If your whole body were an eye, you still would not be able to see it. if your whole body were an ear, you still wouldn't be able to hear it. If your whole body were a mouth, you still would not be able to speak of it. If your whole body were mind, you still would not be able to perceive it. Now, leaving aside whole body for the moment, if suddenly you had no eyes, how would you see? Without ears, how would you hear? Without a mouth, how would you speak? Without a mind, how would you perceive? Here, if you can unfurl a single pathway, then you'd be a fellow student with the ancient Buddhas. But leaving aside studying for the moment, under whom would you study? This is great. If your whole body were an eye, you still would not be able to see it. Have any of you ever seen your own eyeball?
From the inside out?
Well, is there an inside? Is there an outside? That's the issue here. This is about subject and object. Is there a hand? Is there a pillow? Are they separate? If your whole body were an eye, you still would not be able to see it. If your whole body were an ear, you wouldn't be able to hear it. So listening to sound, can you hear your ear? What is it you hear? Once when I was pretty young, maybe 10, maybe younger, somehow it came to me to try and hear the sound of sound. If your whole body were a mouth, you still wouldn't be able to speak of it. If your whole body were mind, you still wouldn't be able to perceive it. If there's just seeing, is there something else to see? How do we get unstuck from speaker and that which is spoken of? So this is worth, you know, these koans, these teaching stories, you know, they're not something to figure out. They're not riddles that you need to find some answer to. They're not nonsense. Sometimes that's how they're described in, you know, Zen books that by people who don't know what they're talking about. They're not, you know, riddles to solve. There's not one answer to them. They're not. You know, anyway, what's going on here? This is a wonderful introduction. This first half of the introduction is worth, you know, just hanging out with, spending some time with, memorizing and sitting with. If your whole body were an eye, you still wouldn't be able to see it. If your whole body were mind, you still would not be able to perceive it. Who would it be perceiving? And what would it be perceiving? Then he says, now leaving aside whole body for the moment. If suddenly you had no eyes, how would you see? Without ears, how would you hear? Without a mouth, how would you speak? Without a mind, how would you perceive? And I would add, if suddenly you had no eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, or mind, how would you see? Here, if you can unfurl a single pathway, then you'd be a fellow student with the ancient Buddhas, but leaving aside studying for the moment, under whom would you study? Thank you. So in some ways, getting into these stories spending time hanging out with what's going on with the story. I mean, it's so simple in some ways. What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes for? Oh, it's just like someone reaching back, groping for their pillow in the middle of the night. What is true compassion? How do we respond to the suffering of the world? There's lots of suffering. There's lots of need. So, comments or responses to either or both of these introductions or any piece of them? Doug?
Well, it seems to me that both of the introductions are not necessarily, I think they're a little different from the main focus, at least at the beginning of the case.
Uh-huh.
In talking about thusness and, or at least starting out with the general emptiness and non-duality, the inability, non-separation of I and what's in the inability of the I to see itself.
Uh-huh.
I think the case certainly moves that way, especially as it gets toward the end. But I think the beginning is a little different with the Bodhisattva with the hands on the eyes, and for that matter, the tools and all the hands. It's not, like Aishin said, there's this non-separation. There's seeing and acting immediately to respond to suffering. And in a way, the reaching for the pillow is like that. You're sort of groggy, you're not really thinking about it, you're not uncomfortable, you adjust the pillow. But that's also an interesting image of non-duality, because it's how does Avalokiteshvara help the world? Well, the image is of someone taking care of their own discomfort. It's almost as if Avalokiteshvara is the cries of the world and the pain of the world are perceived by Avalokiteshvara as his or her own pain.
Yes, good.
In one way, it really is talking about action of form and interaction. In a way, I think later on, there's more of a game of form, but the thusness, emptiness, form coming together is thusness, and the play on whether the body is covered with hands and eyes, or the body is hands and eyes throughout.
Mm-hmm.
It seems more sort of like the overall thrust of both collections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for a long time I'm still not sure about this, you know, throughout all over the body or throughout the body. I mean, one scene maybe is deeper, but hands and eyes. But I think that maybe Jacques Roche is here. So I think, are there other comments before we take our mid-morning break? Yes, Paula.
What I was seeing is a little more simplistic, in that we use the senses as the primary way to make judgments.
Yes.
About everything around us. And then to reach real compassion, that's why there's this interplay of juxtapositions with senses and all this stuff, that you almost have to go either beyond it or below it. It has to go deeper than just ears, eyes, nose, mouth, touch. It has to go either combining it all or separating it all, but it has to go much deeper than that, so that initially we're not making judgments about what is going on around us to access true compassion for what is going on around us.
Say that last.
That we have to not make judgments in order to access real compassion.
Okay.
And the senses are the primary way that we make judgments. As human beings, we can't help it almost.
I wonder, though, because sometimes... there's judgments and there's distinctions. So I can feel this, I can feel this. So we, through the senses, we see different colors, we hear different sounds. There's judgments, which is evaluations where we judge good or bad and that kind of thing. And so I wasn't sure what you meant by judgments. We do, through the senses, we see differences. We don't have to necessarily say this kind of thing is better than that kind of thing. So I think there's a question in what you said. How do we see differences? So one question anyway. Maybe I'm missing the main point that you made, but one question is, Can we see differences without making judgments? But then also, how do we not get caught in the differences at all? Which I think is more what you were getting at.
Or do we have to make judgments in order to have compassion? So then it goes right back to that.
Well, but
is
then,
something good or bad?
I don't know that we have to make judgments, but I think part of what the Bodhisattva compassion is about is seeing differences. So knowing how to respond. So part of the different forms and part of all the different hands and the different tools and the different eyes is seeing how to respond compassionately with the different tools to different kinds of beings. How to respond to suffering of people in different realms. How to see the difference between the suffering of beings in hell realms and animal realms and respond in an appropriate way or just, So part of skillful means is exactly noticing and hearing differences, but then finding the immediacy of response in either case. So it's an important question. The difference between discerning differences and then how do you not reify them, not make them something that you make evaluations about? So, yeah, thank you for bringing that as a topic. Yes, Jerry.
I guess my question is, if you can't see your own eye,
yeah,
how do you see suffering at all? And if you don't see it, how is one?
Well, that's
something you don't see.
Good. So, yes, that's a wonderful question. Thank you. So, sit with that, please. So, welcome, Shahak Roshi. We'll resume, and I'm very happy to have Shahak Okamura Roshi here. And just to say a little bit, an introduction, I spoke about him this morning, but Shohaku is the teacher at Sanshin Zen Community, based in Bloomington, Indiana, but with many other groups, and Shohaku's translated many, many texts and written many books, translated texts about Dogen. We've done a few workshops together. He was here once before, and I'm very, very happy that you finally arrived in Chicago after various trials and tribulations, but very happy to have you here. So we will continue with discussing Yunyan and Dawu and the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, Kanon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm really happy being here again. Unfortunately, I was late.
Oh,
Yesterday I stayed at the Indianapolis airport for more than 10 hours. And I finally arrived at the hotel around 10 o'clock and wake up at 4 o'clock to get a taxi to went to the Amtrak station by 5:30. In 4 o'clock in Indianapolis, it is 3 in Chicago. So I'm really sleepy. So, but I try to not to sleep while I'm talking. Well, I appreciate Taiden-san that he gave introduction about this retreat, study retreat, and he told me he talked about who Kanon or Avalokiteshvara is, and Yuyang or Ungang and Dao or Dogo, and the story about the great compassion bodhisattva. This year in May at Sanshinji, we had a 5-day Genzoe. Genzoe is a retreat to focus on studying Shobo Genzo. And we studied Shobo Genzo Kannon, that is Avalokiteshvara. Then I studied Dogen's comments on certain koan, certain famous koan. If I can find in other Zen texts, I try to study those texts. And I also try to find all possible versions of the story. And I found the story or the comments on this koan in both Hekiganrok or Blue Cliff Record and Shoyorok or the Book of Serenity. You talked about those two texts.
Yes.
Great. Hekiganrok has been used in Rinzai tradition, and Shoyorok or Book of Serenity is made in Soto tradition. In China, both are made in China. And of course, Dogen Zenji is from Soto Zen tradition. But Dogen Zenji was very kind of a unique person, unique Zen master. Traditionally, he was considered Soto Zen, from the Soto Zen tradition. Therefore, his teaching and practice is exactly with the Chinese Soto Zen teachings, especially Wanshi or Honji, the silent illumination Zen. And Hekiganrok or Blue Cliff Record was compiled by Engo Kokugon or Yuan Wu, and his student, his main disciple was Da Hui or Dai E. And Dai E and Wanshi or Honji are the contemporary. And they were good friends. But Dai E, let me use Japanese pronunciation, because I really cannot pronounce Chinese correctly. So let me call Da Hui as Dai E. Dai E means great wisdom. Criticized Soto Zen style, or so-called Mokusho Zen, or silent illumination Zen. Blue Cliff Record, and the verses in the Book of Serenity, or Shoyorok, was composed by Wanshi or Honji. So these two texts has something to do with this kind of a conflict between two lineages, Rinzai and Soto. But Dogen Zenji respected Engo. the person who made Hiranyaka. But his disciple, Daihui or Daiye, burned Hiranyaka. He had something didn't like about Hiranyaka or about people's addiction to Hiranyaka kind of teaching. So he burned Hiranyaka. And Daiye criticized Huangshi's silent illumination Zen. So here is a kind of a conflict, two different type of Zen teaching in China. And traditionally we thought Dogen came from Huangshi's Mokusho Zen. But these days, especially last 20 to 30 years in Japan, during Dogen scholars, they started discuss whether Dogen teaching and Chinese Soto Zen or silent illumination Zen are exactly same or not. So this is kind of a hot point in contemporary Dogen study. I'm not so much interested in this kind of scholastic argument, but it's interesting. I'm curious about if there is some difference between Dogen's teaching and Chinese Soto Zen or not. Whenever I studied those two texts, Hekiganroku and Shoyoroku, and Dogen, when Dogen discussed about the same koans appeared in both texts. And in this case, this story about appeared in both texts. So I studied Hekiganroku and Shoyoroku on this koan about Ungan and Dogo's discussion. So my focus is study Dogen, but Dogen is a very unique person, and it's kind of difficult to understand how unique he was. To do so, to compare with other people, kind of an interesting point. One of the point he was so unique was about his Zazen manual. We read Hanza Zengi, or Universal Recommendation of Zazen, as our basic manual of Zazen practice. And before Dogen, there was only one Zazengi, or manual of Zazen, in entire Zen tradition in China. That was written, 11th century. That means, Bodhidharma came to China 6th century. So until 6th century to 11th century, for 500 years or more, Zen Zazen is a basic practice of Zen school, and yet no one wrote the manual of Zazen. To me, that is an interesting point. But this person, who was compiled the monastic regulation called Zennen Shingi, wrote a short, very precise manual of Zazen, and that was called Zazengi. Gi means form, so Zazengi literally means form of Zazen. And as far as I know, Dogen was the only person who wrote his own Zazengi. In Rinzai tradition, even today, they use this Chinese Zazengi as their basic manual of Zazen practice. But somehow, Dogen had some criticism against this Chinese Zazengi. That's why he wrote his own. And that no Zen master did such a thing. Both Chinese Zen masters and Japanese Zen masters who went to China had no criticism against what was written in Chinese Zazengi. But somehow Dogen didn't like at least certain point of the teaching. So he wrote his own Zazengi, and he continued to revise his own Zazengi. First, he wrote Fukan Zazengi in 1227. That was the year he came back from China. So he was still 27 years old. And he revised in 1233. That was the year he established his own monastery, Koshoji, in Fukakusa near Kyoto. Probably that was he intended to make that is a very basic text for his student to practice Zazen. But after around 10 years, in 1243, he left Kyoto and left the monastery and moved to Echizen to establish another monastery later named Eheiji. Around that time, he wrote, he revised Fukan Zazengi. So he wrote at least three versions. And the first version is not available today, but it's kind of interesting to compare the second version and the third final version. Anyway, so no other Zen master did such a thing. Only Dogen had some criticism against Chinese Zen, even about this very basic practice in Zen tradition. So I think it's important to understand the nature of Dogen's Zazen, not only Zazen and practice as a whole. That means our practice, even today, we practice Zazen based on Dogen's teaching. So it's important to understand how and why Dogen is so unique even within Zen tradition. That's the reason whenever I studied Dogen's Shobo Genzo about the Chinese koan, and I compare, usually Hekigan Roku and Shoyo Roku and Dogen's comments. And this is very good examples. So that's why I decided to study during this retreat, study Hekigan Roku on 89 case of Hekigan Roku and 54 case 54 in Shoyo Roku. And after that, I talk about Dogen's Shobo Genzo Kannon. Those three are about the very same story. But before I start to talk on those three texts, I'd like to talk, first of all, talk about Dogen's poems on his visit to a very famous sacred place in China as a place where Avalokiteshvara appeared. That is called Mount Potaraka. And Potaraka is Sanskrit. I don't know Chinese pronunciation, but in Japanese we pronounce as Hodaraku, Hodaraku-san. That is a little south from the Tenton Monastery. It's near from Shanghai. So Dogen lived in China. He visited this very famous sacred place as a pilgrimage. So he was about 25 years old. He stayed in China since he was 23 until 27. So around that, I don't know exactly when, but he visited this sacred place for Avalokiteshvara. And he wrote a few poems, and two of them appeared in record. So it's a part of Dogen's extensive record. The final volume 10, is a collection of Dogen's Chinese poems. Among those Chinese poems, there are two poems about his visit to this place. And what he wrote in these poems has something to do with what he wrote in Shobogenzo Kannon, also the very basic understanding of what Avalokite Shobra is, that is common ground of all those three texts. I think Taigen-san already talked about who or what Kanzeo Mosatsu or Avalokite Shobra Bodhisattva is, Avalokite Shobra is considered as a symbol of Buddha's compassion. And originally in India, Avalokiteshvara was a male, but as at a certain time in China, it became female. If you are interested in how and why Avalokiteshvara became a female goddess, there is a book entitled something like Kan In or Kuan In Chronicle, something English book, something like that. In that book, they explain why Chinese people changed Avalokiteshvara from male to female goddess of compassion. So I don't need to talk about that. But when we read this Koan story and Dogen's and other Zen masters' comments on Avalokiteshvara, we have to forget about that image, goddess of compassion. I think that is what he's saying in these two verses. So let me introduce these two verses from Eihei Koroku, or Dogen's extensive record. If you want to check in that book, the first poem or verse appeared on page 616. Our translation of this poem is as follows. The title of the poem is Continuing the Previous Line from Mount Potalaka. Potalaka is the name of the place. People believed Avalokiteshvara appeared and stayed in that place, Potalaka. And in Tibetan Buddhism, Avalokiteshvara is also very important. And Dalai Lama is considered to be the incarnation of Avalokiteshvara. That's why his palace in Lhasa, Tibet, is called Potalaka, or Potala. Anyway, he wrote this poem when he visited this sacred place. Let me read the verse first. The ocean waves crash like thunder below the cliff. I strain my ears and see the face of Kanjizai. Kanjizai is Avalokiteshvara. Upholding this, who could measure the ocean of merit? Just turn your eyes and see the blue mountain. Let me read it again. The ocean waves crash like thunder below the cliff. I strain my ears and see the face of Kanjizai Avalokiteshvara. Upholding this, who could measure the ocean of merit? Just turn your eyes and see the blue mountain. This Mount Potaraka is in the island. It's very close to the continent, but it's in the island. So there are many caves, rocky coast. And it is said Avalokiteshvara appeared in one of the caves. So this is about the caves of where Avalokiteshvara appeared. And that is what people believe. And so Dogen visited that cave, and he hear the sound of the waves crush the rock. That is what he said in the first line. The ocean wave crush like thunder below the cliff. I strain my ears very carefully hear that sound of the waves hitting the rocks and see the face of Kanji Zai. This is an interesting point. You know, he strained his ears to hear the sound, but when he strained his ear and hear the sound, loud sound of water, waves, then he see the Avalokiteshvara. Usually we see something with our eyes, but it seems he is seeing Avalokiteshvara with ear. No. I think you sometimes read this kind of strange things. The name of Avalokiteshvara or Kanze-on is seeing the sound of the world. So Avalokiteshvara see with his or her eyes the sound of the world, means world of people's cry. And sound of people's cry in the world. That means people are suffering in this Saha world. And they cry, they make a sound of sadness and pain. Then Avalokiteshvara sees the sound. But in fact, his name, Kanze-on, means seeing, by contemplating the sound of the world. That is his name. I'm not sure he or her name. So here's a kind of a twist. Usually we hear the sound with our ears, but Avalokiteshvara see the sound. And here Dogen said he see Avalokiteshvara with his ear. When he hear the sound of the waves crash the rock. You know, this is the kind of a strange thing from our common way of using words and thinking. But this is an important point, not only in this poem or our koan about Avalokiteshvara. You know, this Heart Sutra, it said six sense organs and objects of those six sense organs, eye and color, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste, and body and touch, and mind and object of mind. These six sense organs and the object of six sense organs, match each other. So eye and color or shape is connected, bound. And we often we encounter a certain object, we automatically create certain idea or judgment or evaluation. That is what is called karmic consciousness, depending upon where we are born, how we are, you know, educated, and what kind of experience we have been through our lives. About the certain object, we have a certain image, and like and dislike, and evaluation. So there are some kind of a karmic connection. So when we encounter certain things, often we automatically react certain way. That is how we create our karma. We continue our karma and we create new karma by reacting certain object. And that is how we live within samsara. And often this way of life makes our life suffering. How can we free ourselves from this kind of binding between subject, our sense organs, and object, and when these two encounter, something happened in our mind, that those are called six consciousnesses: eye consciousness, consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. And the Heart Sutra say all those 18 elements, six sense organs, six object of sense organs, and six consciousnesses caused by encountering of these two. Those 18 elements called 18 dots are empty. That is the five. It is said, no I, no yet, no nose, no tongue, no body. No color, no sound, no smell, no touch, no object of mind. This is the same point. When we use anything, all those 18 elements are really there, independently and separately. And when we encounter certain things, we react certain way. So here is a separation between subject and object. And by doing something, we try to connect this person with that thing. This first, there's a separation. Then we try to make connection. That is how we usually live in this world as a human beings. And often that is a cause, not often, but almost always, that is the cause of suffering in samsara. Because of our karmic way of doing things, we are not free from the object and from ready-made perception of the object. So how we can become free, liberated from this binding between subject and object is a really important point in not only Zen, but in entire Buddhism. How can we liberate from this karmic way of life? And that is also our Zazen is about. When we sit this upright posture, and breathe deeply from our nose as if the air goes down to our stomach. So we breathe deeply and quietly. And we let go of our thought. This letting go of thought means, when we sit facing the wall. And fortunately, there's no good and bad wall. We don't have like and dislike about this world and that world. War is always war, you know, especially this kind of war. Only exception is when the world of Zendo is wood. There are certain patterns in the wood, and certain things looks like something. Some person's face or something. Then we start to make the story. And I think I like this, I hate that. But usually, the world in the Zendo is plain. So there's no such things happened. That means there's no object. No I object in the Zendo. And we usually sit in a quiet room. So there's not much stimulation from outside in our ear. So it's quiet. And we don't eat. So there's no tongue has no object. But somehow only our mind continue. And we create so many things, like a movie. And sometimes, or often, with those thoughts and idea or images became the object of mind. And if we sit for many years, we started to see certain things appear so often, so regularly. You know, during session, session is an interesting thing. First 1 or 2 days, you know, the things we experienced before session appeared often, and we think, you know, why that kind of things happened, or why that person said such a thing, or why did I say that kind of thing. But after second or third days, we become tired of thinking that kind of things, and it kind of go away. But after that, the thought or image or idea stayed much deeper than that kind of day-to-day things appeared. And those things become the object of our mind. And often we think, I like this idea, or I hate that, or this is like a hell, or this is like a heaven, that kind of things happening. In that case, within our mind, even though there's no object, our mind is divided into two sides. One is the person sitting, and another is those thoughts. So those thoughts became object of this person sitting. So there's a separation between our mind, and we interact like or dislike, or I hate this, or I love that. But letting go of thought means letting go of those interaction. When thought just come up and go away, that's okay. But when we make a separation and interact, then that is not okay. That is, when we do such a thing, we are thinking. And thinking is not the same. Even if we sit this same posture, if we within our mind, if we our mind is separated into two sides and intact, then we are thinking. But when we let go, this letting go means stop this interaction. Then thoughts are just coming and going. It's not, those thoughts are not my object. Thought is just happening. It's really important to see this difference. I'm thinking about some thought, and thoughts are just coming and going, but I don't think. those thoughts are not my thinking. It's happening in our mind, but my mind doesn't see it and doesn't evaluate or make judgment. Thoughts are just coming and going. That is fact. Is very important point. So letting go of thought does not mean we kill the thought or we eliminate the thought coming and going. Thoughts are coming and going almost always. But once those thoughts become object of this person, then we are thinking. It's not zazen at all. So whenever we found we are doing such a interaction between subject, this person sitting, and object, the thought coming and going, then we stopped. This stopping is letting go. So unfortunately, even when we let go and return to just sitting, somehow thought come up next moment, but we keep letting go. That is very important point of our practice in Zazen. In this case, both subject and object are our mind. And there's separation and interaction. This is the way we create, continue and create our karma. But at least when we sit facing the wall, we make determination not to take any action based on this thought coming and going. That is a really important point. That means at least when we are sitting facing the wall and letting go, we don't create new karma. We are liberated from karmic way of doing things, even though karmic consciousness is still working and all different kinds of thoughts are coming and going. Thoughts are there, but I don't think. This is kind of a strange thing, but really, I think, important point in our Zazen practice. And when I talk about my Zazen practice, I always use the analogy of driving a car to explain this strange thing. When we drive a car and put the gear into neutral, the engine is still moving. That means our brain is still working, but the car doesn't move. That means even when we sit in this posture, our stomach is working. Our stomach digests what I ate this morning, and our heart is working, and all the cells in my body are still working. There's no reason, only our brain stop working. And the function of our brain is creating thought. So there's no way, no reason. Only our thought assists to be. So thoughts are coming and going. That's the natural function of our mind, same as stomach is digesting and heart is beating. But at least when we are sitting, because the gear is in neutral, we don't make any action, take any action based on those thoughts coming and going. And those thoughts are not the object of this person. But actually those thoughts coming and going is part, not the part. It's this person, the content of this person. The content of this person and the fact this person has been experiences. So when we make those thoughts as object and we take action based on them, then we make evaluation. I like this idea, I hate that idea. So I make choice, and I do this, and I don't do that. Or sometimes, or more often, even though I don't like that, I do it. That's a problem. But at least during Zazen, we stop doing such interaction between me and myself. So during this sitting, we are liberated from this karmic habitual way of thinking and doing things. To me, this is really important point of our Zazen practice. And then, you know, in Zen literature, this kind of things, you know, hearing something with our eye, or seeing the sound, that kind of thing, strange expression appeared, that means this habitual karmic bondage between subject and object is cut off, and we are free from that habitual way of thinking and doing things. And that is revelation. So Avalokiteshvara, when Avalokiteshvara see the sound of the world, the sound of the world is not the object of this person, of Avalokiteshvara, but that is Avalokiteshvara, the content of Avalokiteshvara, that why Avalokiteshvara can appear to help. Without making discrimination, that is one of the point of this story. So that is my understanding of first two lines of this Dogen's poem. And the third line is upholding this. Upholding this means seeing Avalokiteshvara with ear. You know, this liberated way of life. Upholding this, who could measure the ocean of merit? That means the merit of this ocean means in this poem, this ocean of course means the ocean surround the island, but this ocean is Buddha's compassion. So the merit or virtue of Buddha's compassion is boundless. There's no way we can measure it. So the merit or virtue of our Zazen, just letting go, is as boundless as Avalokiteshvara's compassion. And finally, he says, just turn your eyes and see the blue mountain. So when he turns his eyes, he sees the mountains instead of the ocean. Here, you know, he sees the mountains with his eyes, I think. So when he hears the sound of waves crashing the rock, and he sees the mountains, here is Avalokiteshvara. Did he really encounter with Avalokiteshvara or not? He doesn't say, you know, when he hears the sound of the waves, he sees the Avalokiteshvara. But does he really see as object? I don't think so. And when he sees his eyes, with his eyes, he just sees the blue mountains, no Avalokiteshvara. What this means, I think this is really important point to understand this story of this conversation between Ungan and Dogo. Where is Avalokiteshvara? Is Avalokiteshvara such a kind of a person or a personalized or symbol of compassion as a person, is there such abhaktashubha really existing or no? And it seems he says no. He only hears the sound of waves, and he only sees the blue mountains. And what he, and I think what he's saying is this, you know, world in which, you know, ocean waves are moving, and the mountain looks immovable. These are themselves Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is not a person or not a symbol or a goddess, but Avalokiteshvara is what is happening within this world, including Dogen, who is hearing the sound and seeing the mountain. Nothing else. Well, this is my understanding of this poem. And next poem, he more clearly says about his understanding of what is Avalokiteshvara. This verse from Ehe Kolok, or Dogen's extensive record, appeared in page 261. The previous one is number Chinese verse number 28. This is number 45. So these are a little separate. The title of this Chinese poem is written on the occasion of visiting Mount Potaraka in Chang Guo district. So he composed this verse when he built this place, this sacred place named Mount Potaraka, the same place. So again, this is our Taigen and my translation. In the bracket, it said, Guang Yin or Kannon is found. Kannon is found, in bracket. Amid hearing, considering, practicing, and truly verifying the mind. Why seek appearances of her sacred face within a cave? Question mark. I proclaim that pilgrims must themselves awaken. Guan Yin or Kannon does not abide on Potaraka Mountain. Let me read this again. Let me use Kannon, Japanese. Kannon is found amid hearing, considering, practicing, and truly verifying the mind. Why seek appearances of her sacred face within a cave? I proclaim that pilgrims must themselves awaken. Kannon does not abide on Potaraka Mountain. You know, when he wrote this poem, he was around 25 years old. He was still a very young Japanese monk visiting a Chinese monastery to practice Chinese Zen, and visited this sacred place. Many Chinese Buddhists make pilgrimage to that place to make homage to the Avalokiteshvara. But this young Japanese monk said, Kannon is not here. I think for many Chinese people, mm-hmm. This is a strange young Japanese monk. But clear, he more clearly say what is a fabrication. The first line, Kannon is found amid hearing, considering, practicing, and truly verifying the mind. This hearing, considering, or thinking. Hearing, thinking, practicing, and verifying. Those four is a kind of a the process of studying and practicing Dharma. You know, first we hear some teaching. In our case, teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha, or Chinese Zen, or Dogen, and other masters. We hear the teachings, and we think about the teaching, whether you know this teaching makes sense or not, or whether you know, this practice is doable for me. So first we think about the teaching and try to understand intellectually. And then we think, you know, this teaching might be true or make sense to me, or this can be interesting, or can be doable for me. Then we put that teaching into practice. And through the practice, we found that teaching is really true. That is what the verification means. So verification or show sometimes translated as enlightenment. But this, in this case, this is enlightenment as the evidence or proof of the truth of the teaching. And when Dogen says, this is a very important point of Dogen's teaching, when he said practice and enlightenment are one, the word he uses, shu and sho, the third and fourth word in here. That means our practice and the verification, or the evidence or proof of the truth of that teaching. These two are not two separate things, but one thing. That is what Dogen meant when he said, Shusho Ichinyo, our practice and verification are one. That means you don't need to wait until you practice certain period of time and reach certain point to see the evidence of the truth of the teaching. But within this practice, verification is already there. Well, this practice is itself verification. We don't need to wait until you know we graduate from the practice. So, you know, this kind of a process of studying and practicing. First we hear, think, and intellectually understand what this teaching means, and put it into actual practice. And practice in Dogen's teaching, practice is itself verification. So we verify that this teaching is true through our practice, means through our experience. So we don't need intellectual understanding anymore, because you know, teaching and understanding is included within our experience or practice. So not only show and show or practice and verification, but all those four processes are actually one thing. That is what I think Dogen meant when he said practice and verification, or shu and sho, are one reality. second sentence, he said, why seek appearances of her sacred face within a cave? This means Aparopeshvara is in our practice. So why we need to seek after Avalokiteshvara in the cave, in this, you know, mountain or island? Avalokiteshvara is not something outside of ourselves, but Avalokiteshvara appeared within our practice, within our life. In the sutra of Buddha's last teaching, in Japanese we call it Butsu Yuikyo-gyo, this sutra is said, the final teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha, right before or when he was dying. So this was really a final teaching of Shakyamuni. And around the end of this sutra, it is said, you know, after his death, you know, Buddha is dying. So Buddhist Sangha lost a Buddha, one of the three treasures. And Buddha was really important person among his disciples. You know, of course, disciples were very sad, and they didn't know what to do. After Buddha died, Buddha's death, then Buddha said, after my death, you should continue to practice my teaching. And within your teaching, undestructive Dharma body, Tathagata's undestructive Dharma body appear within our practice. So this, in this case, this Dharma body means Buddha's teaching, or the truth Buddha taught, appeared when monks practice. But later, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, this Dharma body grows bigger and bigger, and it becomes this universe itself. This world itself is Buddha's Dharma body. And then we practice following Buddha's teaching. Buddha's Dharma body, eternal and universal Dharma body, appears within our practice, no matter how short and weak and shallow. The Buddha's Dharma body appears within our practice, within our life. So that is Avalokiteshvara in here. Avalokiteshvara appears within our practice. Something eternal, something universal, something formless appears within this very concrete action, activities, using our concrete body and mind. So we don't need to look for the sacred face of Avalokiteshvara in certain fixed place, you know, in China, or, you know, within this special cave. But wherever we are, when we practice wholeheartedly, Avalokiteshvara is there. That's why, he said, I proclaim that pilgrims, or people who visit that sacred place, I think including himself, awaken themselves, awaken. Kannon does not abide on Potaraka Mountain. So he said, Kannon is not here. Kannon is where we are, where we practice, where and when we practice. This is my understanding of the second verse. Almost the same verse appeared in a different text of Dogen. It is said, you know, a record of Dogen's extensive record has 10 volumes, and it's a big book. But that was too big for some people. It is said one of Dogen's disciples, whose name was Kangan Gi-in, he took the entire manuscript of Ehekorok to China and asked Dogen's Dharma brother, one of Tendo Nyojo's disciples, to make selection of important sayings and verses and make it smaller. And the person did. And it became maybe about 10%. Tiny. And that text is called Ehe Do Ehe Genzenji Gorok, the recorded sayings of Ehe Dogen Zenji. And we don't know who did it. Probably that Chinese master, but some of Dogen's expression is changed. Between there are differences between Ehe Koroku and this what do you call modified version. And in this second text, this I think this original the same verse has a little difference. The meaning is not so different, but because this difference is interesting, I'd like to introduce. Interesting means who made this change, and we don't know. Maybe Dogen devised, or maybe that Chinese Zen master did, or maybe someone else in the later age maybe did. And another interesting point is our translation of Ehe Koroku is based on the older version called Monkaku version. But in the 17th, 18th century, a very well-known Japanese Soto Zen master, Manzan Dohaku, he said the older manuscripts are not so good, not in good shape, so he made corrections.
Corrected, okay.
Yeah. Manzan was really great scholars. Scholar monk. So he made, he corrected mistakes. And from his point of view, as a scholar. But now, today, we are not sure what Manzan did was correct thing, right thing or not. So that's why, Japanese scholars today, and also we translated the older version. Older version as a text, little rough. There are some point we don't really understand what this meant. But Manzan's version is more kind of understandable because of Manzan made it understandable. So when we study Dogen, even in our translation, when I don't really understand what this means, I try to translate in the way I understand. That's why it's a kind of dangerous to read only one translation. Anyway, the version of the same verse or poem in this second text is really different. So let me introduce. Entering samadhi, through hearing, thinking, and practicing. Being in the samadhi, the self, becomes solemn, and immaculate, and the sacred face appears. Therefore, I would like to tell people who visit here and enable them to clarify this meaning. Kannon does not abide on Potaraka Mountain. So first two lines are different. But in this version, if this change was made by Dogen himself, he clearly said the self, Jikko. So Avalokiteshvara is the way we really are. That means we are often deceived by ourselves. But when we awaken to the actual way of how we are, then that is Avalokiteshvara. So again he said, don't think Avalokiteshvara live in this mountain. Anyway, this is two verses of Dogen, by Dogen, about Avalokiteshvara when he visited that famous sacred place in China about Avalokiteshvara. And these poems are pointing to aspect of the discussion, all Kigalmok, Shoyorok, and Dogen's Kannon. That is, Kannon is not a symbol of Buddha's compassion as a god or goddess. But one point is, there's no such things called Avalokiteshvara as a person. But the sound of waves crashing on the rock, or the scenery of the mountains, that means this world itself. Before, in Uchandra's expression, before being processed within our mind, that means the world as it is, the way things really are. So when we are not biased by our, you know, karmic consciousness through this bondage between subject and object, that is itself Avalokiteshvara. And the second aspect is Avalokiteshvara appears within our practice, within our way of life. So Avalokiteshvara is there means Ungan and Dogo's discussion is not how we are living together with all beings as a part of interdependent origination, and how we can practice as an individual person, how can we practice in the way we manifest or actualize this reality using this body and mind. This is two aspects of Avalokiteshvara in Zen tradition. This is not only Dogen, but also the discussion in Hekiganrok and also Shoyorok. So that, I think that basic ground is the same within those three texts, but their approach are little different. That is what I'm going to talk maybe this afternoon. Well, that is what I have to say about Dogen's poem on Kannon. Do you have any question? We stop 12:30.
Yeah, well, it could be a little earlier.
Then, if we have time. I'd like to introduce older version of this story.
Okay.
It doesn't take long.
Unless there's, is there some question or
any question about those two poems by Dogen? Is it clear? And do you understand? Do you agree with what I'm saying? I hope so. But
There's a copy of Dogen's extensive record in the library and in the back, so I can put that out so you can look at that during the break.
So when you're talking about the thoughts, and then I guess I would say, reaching out like the thought realm, or that we create that sort of distance between the thought and ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a, are you saying then it's the discrimination between those two, and it's sort of almost like we create a second self?
Yes.
Okay.
We create our own version of the self and the world or object. And we think that is reality. That is a problem. But this problem is really deep. This problem is almost, how we live as human beings. So, that's a problem, really deep problem. It's not a matter of if we understand this, we can make change. We can make change little by little, moment by moment. But this moment by moment practice, I think, continue until the end of our life. That's why Dogen says we have to announce bodhicitta billions of times. It's not a matter of when I understand we can make complete change and become a very different or different person, or we can live a complete enlightened life. But we have to live with this condition until the end of our life. So how can we become friends with this kind of delusion?
I didn't understand. You said we must arouse bodhicitta
billions of times.
Mm-hmm.
That is what Dogen said in Shobogenzo Kotsubodaishin. Okay, when I study this kind of code in Hekigan Roku or Shoyo Roku, these are the text, then text made produced in the Song Dynasty China. Song Dynasty means end of 10th century. You know, Tang dynasties continue about 300 years from 7th to beginning of 10th. And about half a century, about 50 years, China didn't have, after Tang dynasty declined, disappeared, about 50 years, China didn't have one stable government, but small dynasties appear and disappear and appear and disappear. That means they had a very much social disorder. So Tang dynasty then and Song dynasty then are very different. And today, the way we understand them is actually produced within Song Dynasty, the Zen people. And the way the text we understand, what we think of Tang Dynasty Zen, those very famous Zen masters, such as Six Ancestor, or Mazu, or in our lineage, Sekito, or including these people, Ungan and Dogo, within Tang Dynasty. And between Tang and Song, within this very short disordered period, one very important thing happened. That was they started to collect all of those masters' sayings. and first that kind of text was called Sodo Shu. So means ancestor, and Do means home, and Shu is collection. So Sodo Shu means the collection of ancestral home. And this text was made in 950. 950 is in the middle of this disordered period. But somehow this collection, this first collection of the master's biographies and their sayings disappeared from China. And somehow it was stored in Korea until the 20th century. So no one knew that even the existence of this text until the 20th century. This is the oldest text. Sodo Shu is the oldest text about this collection of Zen master's biography and sayings. And the next one was made about 50 years later, 1004. That was already in Song Dynasty, China. The text was called Keitoku Dentoroku, or usually called Record of Transmission of Dharma Lamp. These two are the earliest text in the kind in that group of the collection of Chinese Zen master biographies and sayings. After Keitoku Dentoroku, there are five that kind of collection was made. And those are called Toshi, what is Toshi? The history of Dharma Lamp. Of course, the later the text become bigger and bigger. Because later people are added. Anyway, so these two are Sodo Shu and Keitoku Dentoroku are older than other well-known popular Zen text. And those Hekiganroku and Shoyoroku was made in the 12th century. Actually, Hekiganroku was made in 12th century. And Shoyoroku was collected by Wanshi or Honji in 12th century. But the commentary in Shoyoroku was made by another Zen master who was a contemporary of Dogen. So Shoyoroku was made in 13th century. So there are at least 100 year gap between those two older texts and other so-called clone collections. So it's kind of, to me, it's interesting to compare those stories in the older version, older text, and famous, well-known Zen or koan collection text made in Song Dynasty, China. And after Hekiganroku, this story as a conversation of Do Ungan and Dogo as a koan is almost the same. A little tiny difference of terms, but basically the same conversation. But two older versions are very different. And there are many this kind of examples. So we can see how those koan stories grew. First, it's kind of simple. Then, I think people try to make the story more and more interesting and meaningful. and the story became longer and longer. And this is one of the examples. The Unga and Dogo's conversation in both Sodoshu and Ketok Dentorok are very simple, much shorter. This is my translation. In Sodoshu, their conversation is as follows. Daogu, or Dogo, asked Unga. So in this case, the person who asked was Dogo, not Doge, not Unga. So questioner and the person who made question is different. Daogu asked Yunyan, or Unga, what are the thousand hands and eyes like? What are the thousand hands and eyes like? Hmm. That's all.
Hmm.
It doesn't say great compassion bodhisattva. But of course, this differs to Avalokiteshvara. Ungan's answer, it is like, so this is Ungan, it is like grabbing the pillow in the night without light. It is like grabbing the pillow in the night without light. Ungan asked, do you also know it? So then Ungan asked to Dogo, do you know this? Then Dogo said, I understand. So this I understand is Dogo's saying in this way. Then Yunyan or Ungan asked, how do you understand it? Then Dogo said, the entire body is the eye. The entire body is the eye. So here only said about the eye. Hand doesn't appear. That's the end of this conversation. So let me read it again. Dogo asked Ungan, what are the thousand hands and eyes like? Dogo said, it is like grabbing the pillow in the night without light. Dogo. Ungan said, I'm sorry, Ungan said. And then Ungan asked to Dogo, do you also know it? Dogo said, I understand. Ungan asked, how do you understand it? Dogo said, the entire body is the eye. So much shorter and simple. And in the this appeared in the chapter of Daogu in Sodoshu. And in Ketoku Dentoroku, or record of Dharma translation of Trump, this appeared in the chapter of Ungan, volume 14. Here, Dogo asked, or Daogu asked, which eye of the great compassion bodhisattva with thousand hands and eyes is the true eye? So the question is really different. Which one of the great compassion bodhisattva with thousand hands and eyes is the true eye? So Avalokiteshvara has thousand eyes, and the question, which is his true eye? Then Ungan said. Ungan said, what about grabbing the pillow when there is no light? What about grabbing the pillow when there is no light. Then Dogo said, I understand, I understand. Then Ungang asked, how do you understand? Dogo said, the entire body is the eye. Let me read it up again. Dogo asked, which eye of the great compassion, Bodhisattva, with thousand hands and eyes, is the true eye? Ungan said, what about grabbing the pillow when there is no light? Dogo said, I understand, I understand. Ungan asked, how do you understand? Dogo said, the entire body is the eye. This entire body is the eye is Tsushin Koreme. So in this older version, there's no, how can I say, comparison between two, Ungan's Henshin Koreshigen and Dogo's Tsushin Koreshigen. What's the difference between Henshin and Tsushin? That point is created by someone who made the Song Dynasty version, and later all the masters adapt that version.
I like the question in the later versions better.
Yeah, later version is more meaningful. Earlier version is simple and not so meaningful sometimes. Sometimes we don't understand the meaning even. So they changed those people who revised this story may change in the way it makes sense to them, I guess. Yes. And the important point is, as I said, this text, Sodoshu, was made in 1970, I'm sorry, it's exactly speaking, 1952. You know, Ungan lived 780 to 841, and Dogo lived 769 to 835. So even this oldest version is made about 100 years after they died. So there's no guarantee they had really this conversation or not. There's 100 years. And I think you already know the later version appeared in all those three texts, Kikannok, Shoyorok, and Shobogenzo. So I don't think I need to read this new version. Okay, it's already almost 12:30, so I continue. This afternoon I start to talk on Kikannok and Shoyorok.